Under existing Oregon law, if an Oregon utility moves to acquire another Oregon utility or a part of an Oregon utility, they're required to secure the approval of the State Public Utility Commission. Senate Bill 433 would require the examination of a potential takeover by any party, whether they were an Oregon utility, a non-Oregon utility, or a third party of interest. Secondly, it would require any person intending to take over an Oregon energy utility to submit an application to the commissioner, which would determine, among other things, the applicant's identity and financial stability, financial ability, the source of funds to be used in the acquisition, the applicant's experience in operating public utilities, the applicant's plan for operating the public utility, and how the acquisition will best serve the public utility's customers in the public interest. And it would require the commissioner to examine and investigate that application and to receive and issue an order within 19 days of its receipt. Now, the 19 days is geared to the federal law on that issue. It then provides through that process the Oregon public at large, utility customers, through Oregon regulators, an opportunity to at least examine the proposed transactions and fairly probably not stop it, but to try to maintain whatever interest they might have in the final outcome. My utility hired outside counsel, the board of my utility hired outside counsel to examine the entire question of an unfriendly takeover, and this is one of a series of recommendations that that council has made. If there are any technical questions dealing with the bill, Mr. Dave Hayhurst is here and will be happy to join me at the table and respond to. Again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we urge that you separate those two public issues and that you move Senate Bill 433 with the single public issue to the floor for a vote.
So the single issue is the original.
Yes, the original the bill. Senate A and Gross version of the bill.
Right. And the purpose of that basically is to protect the public against the adverse consequences if there were a takeover that was not in the best interest of the public. Okay. Fair summary.
That's a fair summary.
Okay. Questions? Representative Trahan?
Mr. LaBelle is a former commissioner. With this legislation, how would you see the Public Utility Commissioner reacting? I know what the bill says, but what would the commissioner really look at in one of these situations if it were presented to him?
I think the first thing that a commissioner would look at is what would the effects of a change in the capital structure of the utility, how would that appear after a takeover, and what would be the impact on that in rates. As a practical matter, and I want to make this clear, the commissioner could not stop the takeover of the utility, but at least he could render a determination as to where the public interest lay with regard to the potential takeover. The real effect of this proposal is to put a check mark in the column called Oregon on an investment analyst computer screen that says in Oregon you're going to have to make a full disclosure before you take over an Oregon utility. You can't do it behind the scenes. And it gives the public at least an opportunity to participate. And we think in that regard it's in the public interest. There have been a change in the ownership of two gas utilities, if you broadly define the Pacific Northwest, one in Idaho and one in Alaska. And in the Alaska case, it did require action by the Alaskan Public Utility. It's the Utility and Transportation Committee prior to the takeover. In Idaho, it did not. In Idaho, it has had rate consequences.
Councilor Fahern.
I want to be sure we understood. The commissioner would review this information, report out, I think you said, in 19 days or something like that, but would not be able to stop the takeover as such?
The power and the impacts of a determination by a utility commissioner go well beyond the real authority of the commissioner. An adverse determination by the commissioner can materially affect a third party's ability to finance an acquisition or any transaction for that matter. And in that regard, the decision has a real impact, an adverse decision to the taking over party. I think the full public disclosure, you know, clearly has an impact on a potential transaction, particularly when you're dealing with a third party who is from a remote jurisdiction trying to take over a utility that is substantially an Oregon utility. So while I'm saying that it's my understanding that under federal laws, you could not absolutely prohibit a takeover, and really Mr. Hayer should be responding to this if you want to go beyond that, but that it would be a significant deterrent. There has been a recent court determination upholding a statute, I believe in the state of Maryland, that goes even beyond this statute.
John, regarding the second part of the bill, what's the role of the Public Utility Commissioner in establishing rates and so on when he has to take into consideration the actions by a local government in the way of taxation?
Well, first of all, Representative Anderson, existing Oregon law, and I don't know how long it's been in place, but for a significant period of time, provides the authority for any municipality to impose franchise fees on a public investor-owned utility up to 5%. That's in the existing statute. A commissioner sometime back in history, and I can't pinpoint that for you, by administrative rule provided that the way the economics of that kind of imposition of the tax would be handled for rate purposes was that the first 3% for a gas utility, I think it's 3.5% for an electric utility, would be spread across the entire revenue requirement and then allocated into the rate structures. The effect of that is to spread those franchise costs equally to the various customer classes in and out of the municipality. It does not keep the incidence of the tax within the taxpaying group of the municipality. But that any amount in excess of those figures, the 3 and the 3.5, would be required to be separately stated and passed directly through to the consumers within the taxing jurisdiction. That's by administrative rule. So the commissioner in that case, in determining within his area, when their area of authority, how the incidence tax would fall on the consumers, made that division, and that's the way the law is today.
And John, in some instances, then, an excessive franchise fee or a tax on a utility might be spread out beyond that municipality, and that the rest of the people would have to pick up that burden.
It's clear that it is. It's clear that it is represented.
In other words, if you get down to the nitty-gritty, that is Portland carried through with their threat in the instance of the telephone company now, that I, being a customer of Northwest Bell and Roseburg, would be helping to support the city of Portland?
No, that's not quite correct. You as a telephone customer in the city of Roseburg could very well, within the existing franchise fees that were imposed, without regard to the City of Portland's action, probably are carrying some small fraction of that 3.5% load, just knowing where the revenues fall jurisdictionally. With regard to the increase in the franchise fees that were recently adopted by the City of Portland, though that increase would be borne totally by consumers within the jurisdiction of the City of Portland.
Well, Mr. Chair, in the first part of the bill, your status, or the Public Utility Commission, excuse me, your status as watchdog and advisory and et cetera, and if organized crime was about to take over, then the Attorney General could apply the RICO statutes. But in the second part of the bill, if there's a little bit of piracy going on, the Attorney General's hand would probably be tied.
I think it's clear they would be. I think you'd have to support the existing statute.
Okay. Further questions? You completed your testimony?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Does anyone else wish to be heard on Senate Bill 433? Okay. We do have a letter from the City of Salem that we'll distribute.
They like it.
They don't like it in its present form. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 433. And do something else until my level of comfort increases. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 878. Julia, do you want to contact Senator Bradbury's office? See if they can find the good senator at Senate Bill 878. I understand he wants to testify here today. We want to try to find the representative from Bend who has an interest in this bill. Jim Coel? Welcome, Mr. Coel.
Thank you. My name is Jim Coel. I work in Portland with an agency called PACT, P-A-C-T. That's Portland Action Committees Together. And what I've just placed over here would be a written copy of testimony in regards to the bill and some charts, tables that I think you'll find pertinent information, some statistics on rental populations in Oregon. The information I'd like to present to you today is from public documents that are available from State Community Services and Department of Human Resources across the street, and also from the past 10 years of weatherization programs for low-income people in Oregon. For your convenience, I'll try to keep it all brief and just give you an overview of the current programs and some of the costs and benefits of those. I will urge you now and again later to support Senate Bill 878 as it's currently written, not to amend it or alter it in any further way, that as it stands, it's a pretty well-rounded piece of legislation that will serve people effectively. The Oregon Energy Coordinators Association, which I'm chairperson of, is a statewide nonprofit corporation, and it serves the general public by improving the professional capabilities of the low-income weatherization programs in Oregon. On behalf of that group, I'll talk about the 22 member agencies and what they do. The association members serve every square mile of Oregon and have approximately 20 years of experience in each locale, serving low-income and renter populations. During the past 10 years, these same agencies have been providing weatherization services, and to date have weatherized over 25,000 low-income homes, including rental households. We have been limited primarily to federal anti-poverty funds, and these agencies have approximately 110,000 more households to serve in terms of low-income households. Many of those obviously are renter-occupied. Our association has conducted training on how to operate programs that weatherize rental units, and the Oregon agencies are typically community action agencies or other kinds of agencies that serve low-income people. We both serve them and represent their interests, and since low-income people are a large portion of the rental population, I would like to keep my focus just on the low-income sector. If you'd look at the statistical charts that were provided, the first page of the client statistics There are 8 pages stapled together, so hopefully I'll have these in the right or same order that you do. Approximately like this. The client statistics will give you some indication of the location of these people, the concentrations, the type of heating that they use, the type of clients that live in Oregon, the low-income renter section. If there are any questions about the abbreviations used in these documents or any other of the geographical or political subdivisions that are included in there, I'd be happy to answer those questions, so please stop me. In order to walk you through some of this data, I'll just compare 2 agencies that I'm very familiar with, and you notice some stars. For each 2 pages, page 1 of 2 and 2 of 2, we've only looked at, for the purposes today, an agency called CAP, C-A-A-P, in Portland, representing all the urban area of Portland, and Community Services Consortium, based out of Corvallis. I have specific background in working in both of those 2 agencies as the low-income weatherization program director. They're both Western Oregon agencies, obviously, but I think you'll find a difference in terms of the populations, the urban and rural setting, and I think it'll give you some indication as to the kinds of services that are required in a rental weatherization program. This first page then only indicates to you the kinds of people, the over 60, migrant, Indian, handicapped, those that are employed and otherwise. If you'll turn to the third sheet, which is also called 1 of 2, this one hopefully is titled, if they're in the proper order for you, Type of Dwelling by Agency and County. In that particular one, you can look at the type of fuel, in the order that they're presented to you. The one that indicates fuel type is third section, the very second to the last page. Basically, all I want to point out on the second to the last page on fuel type is that in Portland area, a large portion of the households are served by oil heat, and that for those, there are 40% of Portland's poor people are heated with oil heat. Only 5% of Linn County's households, for instance, Linn, Benton, and Lincoln counties, are served by oil. So a tremendous difference in fuel type experienced by renters, rental populations. Meanwhile, in the more rural counties, Linn, Benton, and Lincoln, as an example, 53% of Community Services Consortium's clientele are electrically heated, where in Portland area that's only 30%. So if I were to digress for just a moment, consider for a successful weatherization program, you need to look at a variety of conditions, the types of clients that are targeted, the type of heating fuel, the type of dwelling unit, and interactions with the property owner. Programs in Oregon have successfully done that for a number of years, and as I've mentioned, we've done 25,000 households to date. I'd like to highlight 2 different levels of weatherization. Typically, people think of weatherization as simply making a home or apartment more fuel efficient in terms of increasing its insulation value in the walls, ceiling, stopping drafts, repairing broken glass, etc. In Oregon, this type of weatherization has achieved approximately 26% energy savings in terms of the amount of fuel it takes to heat the home. There are other weatherization measures that can also be done for a home. Some of you are familiar with, in Portland, an oil burner retrofit program. This is an Oregon pilot project being conducted in the Portland area. It will replace inefficient oil-fired furnace burners with a more efficient flame retention burner. The data from other states indicates a typical savings of 17% to 30%. In short, in the oil furnace sector, a $500 investment for improvements to the furnace will save approximately $100 per year, about a 5-year payback. The first type of weatherization I mentioned, with insulation, etc., in Oregon has an average cost of $900 to $1,200 per unit, depending obviously on apartments versus single-family homes, difference in price. The payback in terms of that kind of weatherization is 7 to 10 years. Obviously, if you were to conduct a complete weatherization program for rentals in Oregon, we would urge you to include furnace improvements as well as insulation measures. This would yield the greatest amount of energy savings and meet everyone's needs. The various measures are listed in other documents, and if you have questions about those, I can answer those. Please now, if you turn to another page called Type of Dwelling, it's at page 1. That's the fourth page in your packet. It'll indicate basically rental and owner-occupied households. It's the 1984 Oregon Low-Income Energy Assistance Program statistics. And there you'll find that for the type of dwelling per agency and per county, Community Action Agency of Portland, for instance, 76% of all the services go to people who are in rental households, a large concentration of renters in the Portland area. In the Community Services Consortium example, Linn County, Benton County, and Lincoln County, only 62% are rental units. So the low-income group of people, the rentals do tend to be congregated in the highly populated areas. Renters in rural areas include low-income people to a larger number. Okay. In terms of Portland, you might also note that there are columns 1, 2, and 3. Of columns 1 and 2, it indicates the number of renters who have heat included in their rent. Column 2, heat not included in their rent. If you'll be looking at a rental weatherization program, there are different audiences and ways to design the program. In terms of landlords, property owners who have included the cost of heating in the rent, obviously those people will have a more vested interest in reducing the cost of the heat, allowing for either a rental reduction for their tenants or perhaps making rentals a bit more profitable. And lastly, I wanted to comment that in regards to the population differences, the Portland area seems to have a greater number of residential hotels and apartment buildings that have single central furnaces that serve all of the units, and weatherization of one of those kinds of complexes would be much different than weatherizing a single-family detached dwelling in the country someplace. In terms of annual income report, there is a sheet which will indicate to you the number of individuals that live in Oregon below poverty guidelines, and it breaks it out specifically to income brackets. And so if you were to look at that particular one, I think the dynamics of the problem become more apparent. This is the fourth to the last page. In terms of these two agencies I've mentioned in Portland and in Linn, Benton, Lincoln counties, 2,761 individuals are living currently in Portland with annual incomes below $2,000 per year. The two agencies together include 20,000 different Oregon residents, which are currently living at below the federal income guidelines, the federal poverty program income guidelines. My comment was that 110,000 households remain to be served at this time. I'd like you to continue with your work by supporting Senate Bill 878, which will enable Oregon to assist its low-income rental residents with weatherization. The example I'll give is that if you can help them reduce a $500 per month per year winter heating bill for a small apartment to $350, that reduction in the cost of heating their apartment will be significant to those people. And with the meager incomes that are indicated on this sheet, you can see that they'll be spending money on food and other important necessities. I'd like to thank you for your consideration of Senate Bill 878. I'm available, as are other staff people, to answer any questions, and I leave you my phone number on the first page of the testimony.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Well,
President Burroughs.
I'm looking at the bill summary and I don't see it in the bill. Requires landlord to provide prospective tenants with specified information on heating costs and weatherization. Weatherization, I understand. How would you have the costs? I mean, it would require that the landlord, probably you have to get that information from previous tenants.
The utilities, we're fortunate in Oregon. The major utilities in terms of electric and gas company are all computerized, and the data on energy consumption for previous years is on file.
By
actual account numbers. So if it's a 15-unit building with separate meters, they'll know room by room or apartment by apartment, if they're separately metered, how much energy is consumed. The impact may be slightly different for people who are heated by heating oil, who perhaps purchase their oil from six different delivery companies in Portland. But for the majority of Oregon, it would be a relatively easy matter for a landlord to request fuel consumption data from Northwest Gas or any of the electrical utilities. The major utilities are all equipped to provide that.
Mr. Burroughs? You'd have to have a hedge factor in there. I mean, if it's someone, like, I'm renting a facility as you described, you know, one heating facility for all the tenants.
Central furnace?
I'm there 4 days a week, basically, five nights. I'm never there. I just sleep there, basically, during the week. If I were there with a couple of children, obviously it would be much different in terms of my, what I would need and use. You'd have to make sure to the clients that they understood there could be a variance. I don't know how much or what to what degree.
Mm-hmm. There is a tremendous difference in terms of lifestyle. A person who tends to heat to 80 degrees year in, year out, and those that seem to get by with 60 degrees. So you're right. A dwelling has a rather predictable energy consumption pattern, and it will depend on lifestyle, but the basic building won't change.
Okay.
So consumption data that you asked earlier about would relate to the type of person who lived there previously and how they set their thermostat.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
I probably mispronounced the name.
That's fine.
This is the next witness. I probably won't. Did I mispronounce yours? Colell?
No. Close.
Close. Mabel D.
Mabel.
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 Mabel. I'm sorry. I just can't read this.
Depew.
Depew. Thank you. And welcome.
My name is Mabel Depew, and I represent the Affiliated Rental Housing Association of Oregon. This is a statewide umbrella organization that consists of 11 local rental owner associations that are located throughout Oregon in Klamath Falls, Medford, Grants Pass, Roseburg, Coos Bay, Eugene, Salem, Portland, The Dalles, Pendleton, LeGrand, and Bend. The majority of our members are small owners who have less than 10 units. Our members are opposed to Senate Bill 878 for several reasons. First, the requirement to provide a resume of the heating costs for 12 continuous months before entering into a rental agreement could certainly result in delays in moving into a unit for both the owner and the renter. If the prior tenant has been there for several years, and I personally have many who have been in my unit for over 10 years, the owner would not have that required information. And this would be especially true in cases where tenants moved out without notice and the owner was not aware and could not get that information in advance. It would also be an unnecessary expense for the utility companies were owners to call for this information to have it on hand just in case. If the utility companies took the week allowed in this bill to get that information to the owner, and the tenant would have to wait a week then to make up his mind as to whether or not he wanted that unit, and the owner would lose that week's rent and possibly longer because the tenant would then decide he didn't want to take that unit. And this could be bad also for new arrivals to the city or people who are transferred and need an apartment immediately. The loss of rent to the owners, of course, would have to be passed on to all the rest of the renters. And while this may not be a problem during times of high vacancy rates, it certainly could be a problem during times of low vacancy rates. Also, what happens if a unit has been vacant for several months during the heating season and the unit was either kept at minimal heat or was not heated? Will the statement from the utility company be detailed enough to indicate this? If the new tenant's bill is subsequently much higher than the previous tenant, will an owner be accused of misleading that renter? Lifestyle determines the heating cost as much or more than the amount of weatherization. Certainly, if three people lived in a unit, and those people liked the unit very warm, had windows open while they had the heat on, and many do, took lots of showers or baths, were careless about using hot water or turning faucets off, stood at an open door and talked, or had children running in and out and leaving the doors open, the bills for that family would have no resemblance to the bills of a single person or a couple. My home is all electric, including the heat, yet my total bill is lower than some of the elderly tenants I have, who have less than half the space I do. The house and apartment are weatherized in the same way. We differ widely in how warm we like to have our home. And once again, in this situation, will the owner be accused of misrepresentation if there is a wide difference in the tenant's bill? Certainly, this bill will drastically increase the paperwork burden for both the owners and utility companies, and that too will add to the cost and pressure to increase rent. Not enough information is available on the number of units that are presently weatherized. This bill apparently assumes that all units built before 1978 are not weatherized. However, the units that I own were erected in 1966. They have plastic under the crawl space, insulation in the walls and ceilings and between floors. The windows and doors are weather-stripped and caulked. The water heaters are under the counter and do not require wrapping. All of this was done at the time they were constructed. In fact, all of the units that were built by my husband at that time were done that way. Yet with the provisions in this bill, I will need to have an energy audit done so that I can prove that the units meet the requirements. This will be the same for many other owners and will be an unnecessary expense that all utility customers will have to pay. This bill could also discourage owners from using a written rental agreement. By not using a written agreement, it appears that Section 8, Subsection 1B would allow an owner to not disclose the information about weatherization. For these reasons, members of ARHA are opposed to Senate Bill 878, and we request that you vote no.
Sarah?
Thank you for the opportunity to express our...
I have a question. What's the relationship between the Affiliated Rental Housing Association and the Building Owners and Managers Association? Are they one subset of another?
What we believe to be the punitive provisions of the measure, this could all be accomplished without the passage of, essentially the passage of 878. And so we certainly,
yes, present form.
We are certainly here, if you need a vehicle for some other good purpose, we are certainly here to volunteer the usage of 878, providing you strip the language that is in it from it.
This is pretty clear.
The intent of 878 that is before you apparently is to try to achieve weatherization of 90% of the rental units in the state by the year 2001. We're not entirely confident that that it will accomplish that purpose. The requirement that landlords disclose the energy usage, that is, in effect, the lifestyle of the prior tenants, we believe is going to send very confusing signals in the marketplace. The language on page 3, lines 33 and 34, that essentially requires the landlord to disclose whether the unit is weatherized or not, is a concept that we advanced in the Senate with the theory that that was a clear and definitive, it's fair to say that it's not a concept that all our membership necessarily thinks a very good idea in there, and implementing it through the audit process has got some practical problems. But
where are you?
I'm looking on page 3, lines 33 and 34. That is section 8, sub 1, sub B. That requires the landlord to disclose whether the unit is weatherized or not. Simple question, is it weatherized to the standards that are established or not? And that could be posted in the unit. And that is something that you can accomplish through the process. It doesn't send a confusing signal to the tenant. If the tenant goes out, because we're talking about two disclosures, that's one of them. The other one is this 12 months prior energy usage. If your tenant goes out and looks at three different units and looks at the energy usage of the prior tenants, they're going to get no signal that they understand, and they're not going to be able to tell whether the unit was weatherized or not based on that energy disclosure, because the difference in energy usage between a weatherized and an unweatherized unit is a lot less than the difference in energy use that arises because of different lifestyles or different number of people in the unit. So we've seen very confusing signals in the marketplace. We're setting up a system that the landlords are going to say, this is a bunch of monkey business. This is supposed to weatherize my units to gather this information that doesn't tell a prospective tenant anything. It's going to bow the backs of the landlords in the field. It doesn't when they're weatherized, they don't have to quit doing it. They still have to do it even after the weatherization has gone forward.
Yes,
so it's not an incentive, it's a penalty.
Fred, just so I'm clear, you're suggesting posting notice as to whether a unit is weatherized or not weatherized?
That is correct, Representative Hill.
According to whose standards? DOE standards?
The language in the that is, and I believe that's in the, that is the effect of what's in the statute. And that was a suggestion that we made and picked up in the Senate. We thought we were presenting that idea in lieu of this confusion.
Well, that's Section 3.
Pardon?
You're talking about Section 3, right?
The well,
method to certify those rental housing units that have received adequate weatherization. So they'd be certified via this method.
Yeah, and then if you look in Section 8 on page 3, Section 8, lines 33 and 34, if you have a written rental agreement, you disclose in the rental agreement whether it's weatherized or not. We've made that suggestion in the Senate with the thought that that was a constructive and meaningful incentive in lieu of this confusing disclosure of the prior tenant's lifestyle. But there was a slip between the suggestion and the language on the paper, and they just added it to instead of in lieu of the other. So we have wound up in effect with two signals. And so our plea with you as far as 878 is to delete from the bill, if you choose to move forward with it, the language that requires disclosure of the prior tenant's lifestyle, that paperwork process that discloses the prior tenant's lifestyle.
Okay, Fred, if I can narrow down, you're suggesting deleting on Section 8, Sub 2, Sub 3, Sub 4, Sub 5, and then delete Section 9 as Section 9, and Section 10 would move up.
Well,
that's the effect of your suggestion.
I would like Sub A and Section 8. Sub 1A, I think, also has to go. I did not prepare those amendments for
well,
you.
We're not in work session. We're
it
just
is,
trying to have a...
But conceptually, you're on the track, Representative.
And the rest of the bill doesn't bug you that much.
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay. Further questions?
Did you have more?
Jim?
Representative Burroughs?
If we have... You went too fast, and I... For some reason, I'm missing A and Gross. You would come back with specific amendments.
That can certainly be provided, you Representative.
The fact of which would be to delete the portions requiring disclosure of utility bills from prior tenants.
Jim.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Irvin for the record, representing the Oregon Multifamily Housing Council, the Oregon State Home Builders Association. We are concerned with 878 in its present form because we believe it's truly disincentives. And if, in fact, what we're attempting to do is retrofit or weatherize existing rental units by the year 2001, let's just go and do it. And we'd like to suggest what we believe, an alternative that will truly achieve that. The problem with existing 878, we're going to be back in 2 years or in 4 years, and you're going to have questions, well, why are not landlords retrofitting? Well, we believe this is truly what is presented here is a disincentive. So what we'd like to suggest is simply that we take 878, and there are good parts of it. For instance, the current marketing program that is in existence that utilities, both public and private, are working toward, we think that's good. And along with that, there are going to be audits, and they're going to go out and audit rental units or housing units and to determine what needs to be done. And we believe that's good, and those audits ought to move forward. In doing so, however, what we ought to do is take the current grant programs that are available, rather than these business tax credits, a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit here, and we just focus in and get the job done. And the current grant program is right now $350 per unit. And our suggestion would be remove that and make it variable and allow the public utility commissioner to set a scale, maybe $200 to $750. And that scale would be determined based on what the audit showed. For instance, in an apartment building that was built in 1947, it obviously may need more dollars per unit than a building built in 1975. Also, a building that is 100 units in size, there may be some benefits to cost of scale, and we, as an industry, believe that there truly are. So we would suggest that you would allow the Public Utility Commissioners to establish a scale to work with the audits as they would come in. And then with that, we would go one step farther, and that is we require mandatory retrofit. If we really want to get there, 90% of the units by the year 2001, we simply go out and say, if the audit says that $350 per unit will do something and we'll get a partial way there, then that $350 shall be used and the owner shall retrofit. We'll give him 12 months to retrofit and we'll be accomplishing something, and in 4 years we'll be back and we'll see some progress. I think this is kind of what we've done with the Building Codes Division proposal, Mr. Chairman. We've talked about the model conservation standards, and what we've tried to do is get two-thirds of the way there for one-third the cost. And this is what our suggestion does here. I mean, the costs are, the grant monies would be provided, the owner would not have to go beyond the grant monies, the grant monies and accompanied with the audit would show what would be cost effective. It is our belief that you ought to focus on four weatherization components. Ceiling insulation, it's easy to get to in most units. Floor insulation, it's easy to get to most units. Door and window weather stripping, and weather stripping hot water heaters that are in cold spaces or hot water piping. But those things we believe can be done very effectively. And again, we may get two-thirds of the way for one-third the cost. And we'd like to throw that out as what we believe is a reasonable alternative because it does the most important things. It ensures that we will meet the retrofit objectives of 90% of the units by the year 2001, and it ensures that we'll meet those conservation needs the most equitable way. So that is our proposal by both the Oregon Multifamily Housing Council and the Oregon State Home Builders Association, and we believe this will get the job done.
And that proposal is mandatory.
Given the way we propose it, mandatory weatherization, using the grant monies in tandem with the audits. For instance, an audit goes out, you have a 20-unit apartment complex, and it shows that for $400 per unit, you can accomplish this. The owner then is said, you shall, and through the administrative rules process, the utility commissioners would require three bids. Whatever you want to do, you have 12 months to accomplish this, you go out and have this accomplished. And in fact, if the three bids don't quite show that it can be done for what the audit shows, there's some means for mitigating that, which could be very easy. I mean, that, by the way, that's already established in the current grant program. So, we use existing policy, and we get away from all these tax credit things, we get away from all these other things that are confusing to people, and you just get out and get the job done.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Egas.
What organization? You represent the home builders, and what's the other organization?
The Oregon Multifamily Housing Council. That's primarily the property management companies and larger rental owners in the state. That council, as we are told, the council represents approximately 200,000 rental housing units in the state of Oregon.
Okay, so you do. You are representing people. You are representing.
Oh, we're representing both owners and developers of rental housing.
Would you recommend similar mandatory conservation provisions for non-rental units?
Yes, because we believe if you've got a leaky sieve out there, if it's good public policy to believe in energy conservation, let's go fix it. I mean, let's just get at it, let's go do it. I mean, and that's what we're dealing with here. Is I read 878, and it looks like the intent of the Legislative Assembly was, at least on the Senate side, was to get to weatherization. Well, it seems like we've been beating around the bush on this issue for a long time, and the problem is you've got to have an incentive program. Well, maybe this isn't incentives, really, but at least what it does is nobody can object to it because it's
ratepayers might object.
That's right.
Majorities might object.
It works. It works. It's clean. It's simple. It doesn't create a lot of problems. It doesn't get involved with loans and payback and accounting. It just gets the job done.
And if I may, one of the flaws, which I didn't speak to in 878, is the fact that it speaks to rental units. And while that's easy on apartment houses, if you go out on the, it would require the utilities to go out on the street and knock on every door to determine, is this a rental unit and isn't it a rental unit? Because in the single-family house area, units fall in and out of the rental market. And the fact that it tries to segregate those, when the only way you can really figure out whether it's in the rental market or out of the rental market is to count it on a given day, because 30 days later it may be in a different status. That's a flaw, a practical flaw in the bill that we spoke to in the Senate, and the Senate did not deal with. We argued in the Senate that it ought to apply, that the provisions of it ought to apply to all units without regard whether they were rental units or non-rental units.
Mr. Chairman, if I may also...
Representative Burroughs asked for recognition a while ago. Representative Burroughs?
Well, just a lot of questions in my mind. The grants would come from the rate base. One of the things I was wondering, when we do an audit, Fred, you were in our previous home. EWEB did an audit, and they said if you do this, you'll save 5%. If you do this, you'll save 10. If you do this, you'll save 8. And we borrowed money and did everything they suggested, which, by the way, came up when we sold the house. I don't remember that anyone asked us what our utility bills were. They did ask if it was weatherized. Some went on to say what, but most just said it has been weatherized, and we could say yes. I guess who would decide how far a landlord would go? The utilities, PUC, the landlord, all these options. Who decides this is far enough to go in weatherization?
Representative Burroughs, Mr. Chairman, we think that's already basically handled now. If you go out and they do an audit in an apartment project, they scale it down just exactly as you said. This is the most cost effective. This is the least cost effective. And we believe that the Public Utility Commissioner could establish a scale of the grant that's existing, by the way. That's all the existing grant is rate payer paid. But you allow the commissioner to establish the scale, and that would interface with the audit. And I think that I think that can be easily determined. I don't think there's a problem with that, because the audit can show economies of scale. For instance, in an apartment complex that's large, they're going to take those kinds of things into consideration in the audit. Does that answer that question?
So, Mr. Chairman, so utilities now do the audits. They would give those to the PUC commissioner.
No, I would think that the PUC would establish the scale, give the scale to the utilities, and they would incorporate that scale in their audit. Right now, they're working with $350 as a scale. It's unitary. You know, allow them some variation. And the utility commissioner may determine that that's not necessary. We just think that obviously for a single family home, you need more money than you need for a 10-unit apartment complex that's in one row. Second comment that I have is one of the problems that the bill does not address is what about mobile homes and the retrofitting of mobile homes and how to address that particular issue. First of all, we don't know if they are federally preempted because of their unique preemption rights by being built to the Department of Housing and Urban Development standards. So they may be, in fact, federally preempted, and I think that the committee needs to look into that issue, because it is a major concern to, for trying to attack this problem again. Let's get to the where the problems occur.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Eakins. Did you make this proposal to the Senate?
Representative Eakins, I'll tell you, this proposal came over several glasses of wine the other night. We started thinking about it, and the more we thought about it, we started passing it around to our members, and obviously some of our members were concerned. But they all said, well, in reality, if it works and there is a grant program, why should there be any objection?
Frankly, if I may, the concern of our members is that if we even mention the word mandatory, why the theory was that the legislature would take the word mandatory and apply it to several thousand dollars worth of weatherization on all the rental units and create great agony. And so the concern was that the legislature might take the word mandatory and move it on into the area that that people would have trouble coping with financially.
So that's...
We promise to resist such an effort.
Definitely.
Well, if it's on a grant basis,
No objection.
It's just what the level of the grant is.
That's correct.
That in effect is correct.
They don't have that financial problem since it's a grant.
That is correct.
There's a little problem of financing the grants, but...
I guess, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burrows.
Then we go back to the argument we've had before in this committee many times. You're going to increase the rate base, so some of us who have borrowed money are going to be paying for those who, so we can give grants to others. And that was an argument that came up before, and I'm sure it'll be around again, and I'm feeling it right now.
Representative Burrows, in the long run, we're not in work session, but in the long run, if we keep from building more Trojans, then we all win. Sarah, I believe you had a question.
Mr. Irvin, I'm a little slow, and that's pretty typical for me, but you mentioned that you felt ceiling insulation, floor insulation, door and window treatments, and insulation of pipes and water heaters were probably the best things that could be done in rental housing. The current loan or grant to property owners of rental property would be $350. Clearly, $350 would not cover the full cost of all that. So, I guess I'm a little confused. Do you mean that you would support having the rental property owners pay the rest of that amount, so we don't have a partial weatherization occurring, but we would have a fully weatherized, meeting those four criteria? Is that what you would put forward?
Speaker, Mr. Chairperson, definitely not. Clearly, we want on the record that we would not support anything of that kind. That's the reason why we set the scale. If it came over that amount and was necessary to make that unit truly cost effective, remember, we're talking again like the BCD proposal, two-thirds of the way for one-third the cost. So you make the determination through the audit. You go as far as you possibly can that's reasonable. We're getting some conservation and avoided cost at the same time, future cost at the same time.
Okay.
The issue about windows, clearly let me bring one thing to your attention. We're talking weather stripping of windows. It's very costly to go in and put storm windows over, and what really needs to be done in rental units is window replacement because of maintenance, escapement problems in bedrooms, opening two sets of windows, and those kinds of things in a rental housing. So that's very costly. Also, wall treatment, interior wall treatment, if it's already has existing insulation in it, it's difficult to retrofit. But those areas, if you have some ceiling insulation, generally, if you've got a 412 or 512 pitch, you can add more easily. You can do things with the floor. These are easy access areas, and those are the things that we believe, again, trying to get two-thirds of the way for one-third the cost.
Well, thank you very much, Jim and Fred. I'm going to have to end the public hearing on Senate Bill 878, just with the comment that, once again, it doesn't look like all the work was done in the Senate.
Surprise.
This seems like, you know, all the problems weren't solved. Plenty of things. So we'll close that public hearing. Then we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 185. We'll do whatever we can with 185. I'll open a whatever. Representative Rayhart.
I think probably that's accurate because it's a loan bill.
All right. I don't know what to call it. Other than a work session on a loan bill. I'll open a session on the loan to Senate Bill 185. Would like Terry Drake from Revenue Staff to join us in the discussion. This bill was referred to us on a motion by the Vice Chair of the Revenue Committee.
When the Chairman was out of the room.
Because it does bring up land use statutes. And my very brief understanding is that if 185 were adopted in this form, it would endanger legislation which we just passed out relating to dog kennels, might possibly endanger aquaculture, and might possibly even endanger the crippled and senior housing measure that we just passed, because we added, you know, to these sections of non-farm uses that would be conditional uses on each view. Terry?
Maybe if I could just provide you a little bit of history of why I think this bill has come to you, and I think speaks specifically to the concern about some other changes you may have made with respect to these particular areas in the statute. You're having handed out the impact statement and the analysis. If I can, I'd like to, I believe you have seen Gross Senate Bill 185 before you. I think it'd be most easy for me to work with the bill itself, because I think I'd point out directly the two areas of concern with respect to land use issues rather than taxation issues.
And we're all working on the C engrossed bill.
C engrossed 185. There were, background on the bill, this is a Department of Revenue bill, and it was aimed primarily at some streamlining of the assessment and appraisal function, a housekeeping bill, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The two provisions that affect or deal somehow with land use are encompassed in primarily in pages 2 and 3 of the bill. There are two issues, and I'll point them out in sequence. The first is on page 2 of the bill, or beginning in section 3, line 7, ORS 308-403. That current language deals with how to handle farm use assessment when there is a determination that the exclusive farm use zone is not a qualified exclusive farm use zone. The way it becomes not qualified is that it doesn't meet some of the criteria that are listed in 213. Upon the determination, in order to get farm use assessment, exclusive farm mm-hmm. use special assessment, you have to meet two criteria. One, you've got to be in EFU zone. Two, the property has to be in farm use. So what happens here is the assessor determines, and this is a rare circumstance, but it does happen. The assessor determines there's an error in the ordinance that created the EFU zone. There's a use that's being allowed that's not on the list of 213 accepted uses. So the assessor determines, this land does not meet one of those criteria necessary for special assessment. What's the assessor do? The existing law says that the assessor continues to value that property as if it was in an EFU zone for up to a year. If the governing body does not come in and change its ordinance,
mm-hmm.
re-qualify that zone as an EFU zone for tax purposes, then the property automatically goes into another type of special assessment, non-EFU special assessment, where there's an application required, the rollback is slightly different.
Income.
Et cetera. There's a number of other tests with respect to meeting that, a more rigid requirements basically with respect to getting that mm-hmm. special assessment. The Department of Revenue determined that there's kind of a window here, because what happens when, let's say the governing body does not requalify the zone, it goes into this other type of of farm use assessment. In farm use special assessment, you got a little clock running on a payback and times the number of years you've been in that program. Well, it was determined that technically in the law, when because of some governing body error, for the most part, the land switched from EFU special assessment to non-EFU special assessment, somebody restarted, set the clock back to zero and restarted it. So that what could happen, because this is a seldom occurrence, what could happen was that the property could have been in EFU for 10 years with, by the way, up to 10-year rollback if they changed use. Through a technical error in the zoning, be switched to non-EFU and restart the clock, and, for example, the owner waits a year and takes it out of farm use, pays a 1-year rollback, even though they've been under farm use special assessments of some type for 11 years. That was the concern. That was the example that was used to explain why this, you see the removal of this language on lines mm-hmm. about 16 through 32 on page 2 of the bill, and replacing it with an attempt to make a simpler system when this occurrence takes place. The simpler system is lines 33 through 38, which basically says, forget playing between whether you're EFU or non-EFU. Leave them in EFU and provide a directive to the county governing body to requalify that. The directive says they should do it within 6 months. For special assessment purposes, that land is kept in its EFU assessment for the 6 months, or for that matter, forever, until that property is requalified as EFU zone. in order to avoid the situation where you switch from one type of special assessment and to another, and somebody sets the clock back to zero in terms of the number of years. That is what this is designed to do. The sensitivity with respect to this area is, again, we're in that area of coordination or lack thereof between farm use special assessment and the zoning laws. The attempt here, the stated attempt, is to not change any land use policies with respect to of the legislature. The attempt here is to deal with the problem, potential problem in farm use special assessment. Nevertheless, you're in an area that refers to zoning laws. That's the first issue. The second issue is primarily on page 3 of the bill, and what it attempts to do is to remove, remember I said that there was two criteria you had to meet in order to get special assessment. You had to be in an EFU zone, you had to be currently using that property for farm use. In 308, ORS 308, which is the 38370, which is the special assessment for mm-hmm. farmland, it refers to the requirement that the land be in currently used as farm use. As it turns out, it referenced that list of things that are allowable farm uses are in 213-203 that you see on page 3 of the bill. The argument was made this, and it really the language begins on line 14, current employment of land for farm use includes, and there's your list. The argument was made that this current employment of land for farm use is only utilized for purposes of special assessment. It is not utilized in making land use decisions. This is the list that you need to qualify for the special assessments. The argument is made, let's move that from 213 to 308. And that's primarily what the rest of this bill does, is it takes this language on page 3 out of 213-203, and then on page 7 of the bill, it inserts it in 308-370. And you see the bold new language. Mm-hmm. So again, the attempt was to simplify the reference to requirements under the special assessment procedures by putting them all in one place.
But the effect?
The effect, and this is a question that came up repeatedly on the Senate side, does this make any substantive change in land use policy? The answer was put specifically to LCDC, the answer was no, it does not. There's still a concern.